Welcome to our second panel of the day. My name is Eddie Grime, and I'll be the moderator. I'll be introducing our guest here in just a moment. But thanks to all of you for joining in on what is probably a beautiful day across our great state. And all four panelists are coming to you live from our beautiful capital, Jefferson City, Missouri. But none of us are together. We are all separate in different locations. So let me go ahead and begin to introduce our panelists. We'll then have two and possibly a third topic on redistricting issues. We're going to focus today on state legislative redistricting after some recent changes. And those issues were litigated by Mr. Hatfield, who's here today. I think Mr. Ellinger has served on panels and has litigated these issues. And Senator O'Loughlin actually served on the House Redistricting Committee 10 years ago. So let me move right into that. Senator Cindy O'Loughlin was sworn into office on January the 9th, 2019, to serve the residents of Northeast Missouri's 18th Senatorial District. In addition to her public service, Senator O'Loughlin has served as vice president of Lee O'Loughlin, Inc. for the past 26 years. Senator and her husband own and operate a trucking company and ready-mixed concrete business with locations across the state. Now, Senator O'Loughlin serves as the chair of the Senate Education Committee and works to improve education outcomes for all of Missouri's children, regardless of where they live. Senator O'Loughlin has been a member of various civic organizations, such as the Shelby County Chamber of Commerce and Industry and the Shelby County Economic Development Board. He's also served on numerous statewide boards, such as the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Missouri Club for Growth. She's currently a member of the NRA, Missouri Cattlemen and Farm Bureau, and the Macon First Baptist Church. As I mentioned also, 10 years ago, she was on the House Redistricting Committee. We'll learn more about that in a moment. Next, we have Mark Ellinger, who graciously lent me his large conference room from where I'm speaking right now. He is a founding partner of Ellinger & Associates, LLC, and he represents business individuals and organizations and committees. He focuses his practice on election law, legislative and rulemaking practice, municipal finance and structuring, issues of state and federal constitutional law, gaming law, and appellate practice, and has achieved a Martindale-Hubbell AV preeminent rating. He served as legal counsel for the Missouri State Auditor in 1993. He handled a range of advising and constitutional tax matters for the auditor. He transitioned to private practice in 1999. Prior to founding Ellinger & Associates, Mark was a member of Blitz Barget in Jeff City. Mark is also actively involved in representing business and individuals in gaming law, especially with respect to the Missouri Gaming Commission license compliance matters. He's one of only two Missouri attorneys recognized as a general member of the International Masters of Gaming Law and is recognized as a super lawyer in the gaming area. So you've got many lawyers in one with Mark Ellinger. Finally, we move to Charles W. Hatfield. He draws on Chuck Hatfield to most of you. He draws on 25 years experience litigating and negotiating very high profile cases, primarily involving some sort of state action. To help offer clients a broad and insightful perspective on Missouri's government and judiciary. In his regulatory practice, Chuck has handled matters involving every department of Missouri government. As an outgrowth of his regulatory-based litigation, Chuck is a highly rated commercial litigator. He defends complex high-stakes litigation, including class actions involving regulated industries such as securities, insurance, and merchandising practices. He chairs Stinson's Financial Services and Class Action Litigation Division and its Government Solutions Group. There's many other things I could say about Chuck, but I'll say he served as lead counsel before the Missouri Supreme Court in Legends Bank versus State, which successfully challenged the constitutionality of the last round or two rounds ago of campaign finance and ethics litigation. He served with co-counsel with me in another federal litigation challenging the next round of Missouri campaign finance. And he's represented dozens of clients in Missouri's initiative petition process, writing proposed changes to Missouri law and litigating initiative petition and signature challenges, including one that I think he just filed a few days ago. So he's right back there in the mix, right in the game. Okay, let's move on now from our speaker bios and talk a little bit about what we're going to cover today and what we won't. So when we talk about redistricting, that's kind of the new topic now. The census is coming out, and many of you are starting to see articles about what kind of data we're going to use and when we're going to get this data to redistrict. Now, there's two basic kinds of redistricting. One is congressional districting. That's where we draw the districts for the representatives who we send to Congress. Okay, that is something that is an interesting topic. It is controlled by the Missouri Constitution, but we are not, in fact, going to be covering it here today. Instead, we're going to cover state legislative redistricting. Now, like congressional redistricting, state legislative redistricting is also subject to federal constitutional law, the U.S. Constitution. However, it's also subject to the Missouri Constitution. And there have been a lot of changes in the Missouri Constitution recently on state legislative districting. And so we are going to focus a little bit today on what those changes were. I'm going to give you a very, very basic summary of what changed before moving into the first topic, where we're going to cover that a little bit more detail to hear from our three panelists. So what has changed? Let's just go from the last cycle. Well, 10 years ago, the big emerging issue was, can we do partisan gerrymandering claims at the state or federal level? And that question was litigated in federal and state courts. It was actually litigated in Missouri. And our Missouri Supreme Court followed a plurality from the U.S. Supreme Court and said, we're not going to do partisan gerrymandering claims in Missouri, at least under the federal constitution. And so that's one thing we knew heading into this cycle that we didn't have before. Since then, we had federal litigation over the last couple of years that answered the question that never really was answered until recently about whether partisan gerrymandering is a viable claim under the U.S. Constitution. And the answer to that appears to be no. This litigation bounced back and forth. We had many different cases, one from Wisconsin, and then finally one from North Carolina and Maryland. They were taken up together. And those cases basically told us that as a matter of the U.S. Constitution, even if there existed something called a partisan gerrymandering claim, we're not going to find that people have standing to raise those. It's not a justiciable question. And so that's a state of federal law. That is one piece of the many other changes that are going to apply in Missouri. But there were some other changes too. In 2018, a measure passed by a large majority called Clean Missouri. And Clean Missouri changed many parts of the Missouri Constitution, added some new sections in. It survived a single subject challenge, and which advanced as far as the Missouri Court of Appeals. Transfer was denied on that case. And so the Missouri Supreme Court never took it up. And so it went to the voters. And the voters, as I said, approved it by a very large majority. It enacted campaign finance reform, lobbying reform, talked about, I think, keys to the Capitol. But maybe the most important thing about this was redistricting. So it basically got rid of Missouri's old system of having the nuts and bolts of the drafting of new maps being done by a House and a Senate committee. And then if they couldn't reach a solution within, I think it was 6 months, it would then go to committees of judges, which has happened several times before in Missouri history. Got rid of that and said we're going to have a nonpartisan state demographer. And that demographer will use the following criteria. And it listed those criteria in order of preference, which is something, again, new to Missouri. It also explained the process by which the demographer would be chosen. There was a back and forth process involving state legislative leadership, and then ultimately the auditor would choose. And there's still a point of debate, I think, about how important the auditor's role would be in that. But essentially, the system for choosing the demographer was sort of a back and forth process involving two branches of government. But the most significant part of the Clean changes to the Missouri Constitution is that Clean adopted a formula that was being used in federal litigation called the efficiency gap. And so Clean would have required an efficiency gap calculation for Missouri, which roughly would have required the districts to be drawn a certain way based on hypothetical gaming out of what elections would look like in Missouri. And the theory of the efficiency gap is that each party ought to be able to translate its electoral strength into legislative strength at approximately equal rates. That's the stated normative goal of the efficiency gap. That became the very top priority. And then everything else, well, I should say the US Constitution always remained the top priority. Everything else filtered down from that. So compactness, contiguous districts, and other rules about county drawing and city drawing, keeping those within districts, those all fell below the efficiency gap. Okay, fast forward to last fall, a measure to reorder those criteria and move the efficiency gap down to the bottom and then move to the top of that list, basically the principle of keeping communities of interest or political subdivisions together, that was enacted by the voters. We also got rid of the nonpartisan state demographer and went back to the committee system we had before, but with significant changes to who could be on the committees and who appointed those committees. So I tried to give you what I thought was a rapid fire review of what Clean did, and then what the fixing of Clean, or some would say the mangling of Clean, that's probably one of our debates today, did in November. So the very first question for our panelists, and I'm gonna go in this order. I will start with Chuck, and then I will go to Mark, and then I will go to Senator O'Loughlin. What I wanna ask you to do initially here is tell us what you think. I want you to predict the top three ways that Clean, and then the revisions to Clean on top of that, will change state legislative redistricting this cycle as compared to the last cycle. And so I've told you all before that I was hoping you could do this in 12 minutes, but we're gonna make it go even faster. See if you can speak as quickly as I am. I'm gonna ask you to try to do it. I'm gonna ask you to try to do it in about 8 minutes. And so we'll go Chuck, 8 minutes, Mark, 8 minutes, Senator O'Loughlin, and then I'm gonna have you guys fight each other after that. Okay, so first, Chuck, please go ahead. I'm gonna mute myself.
Well, thanks, Eddie. I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage. One thing you left out of Mark's bio, I think, when you were going through, is that Mark also served on the last redistricting committees. And so I'm at a bit of a disadvantage because both Mr. Ellinger and Senator O'Loughlin know way better than I do what really goes on in those rooms and how it really works. But as an outsider and just having read some of the case law and followed this issue pretty closely, you said three ways. I don't know if I'll get to three. I'll let you know. Sometimes when I try to list things, I have to tell you how long my list is going to be before when I get there. I think number one is it's very clear now that drawing districts in a way to protect partisan advantage, to protect incumbents, is lawful and is not something that the courts are going to interfere in and address. The case that Eddie talked about that went to the Supreme Court, the Rucho case, came out of North Carolina and Maryland. Perhaps for the reason that those are Republican legislatures and Democrat legislatures. There was one of each, and the partisan gerrymandering was, if I can editorialize, sort of equally aggressive by both the Republicans in North Carolina and the Democrats in Maryland. And so I think that to a certain extent, the committees that draw maps are going to be more empowered to the extent they did not feel empowered or to the extent they felt limited, but more empowered to openly discuss and advocate for protection of partisan interests. You know, in the Maryland case, for example, where the Democrats drew, I believe it was 7 of the 9 congressional districts in their favor, even though statewide they were only getting, you know, in the high 50, low 60% vote. The evidence in that case was, as I recall, and somebody may have read it since I, that the consultants who helped draw the maps was specifically instructed to produce a certain number of Democrat seats and specifically instructed to protect the incumbents, something that I think we all assume happens, but that was the evidence in that case, that that was the goal from the very beginning. And again, to the extent that anybody was reluctant to sort of say those types of things out loud, I don't see any reason that they need to be in the future. That type of activity is not going to mean that your map gets overturned. I do think, however, that because, okay, and then Eddie, I don't know if you mentioned this, but in Rucho, it was interesting, the Supreme Court specifically mentioned Missouri's efforts in amending the Missouri Constitution. And so the U.S. Supreme Court said, this is a political question. It's a non-justiciable issue for us. But the states, of course, could go adopt their own constitutional provisions that might affect the way the states choose to draw their maps. And so in the latest iteration of CLEAN, we do have now a provision that says consider the partisan makeup of the districts, although it is much lower than it was. And so I think I'm only going to give you two ways. I think that it's going to both empower people to be more candid about what the objectives are, again, to the extent they weren't before. But secondly, I think there, you know, there should be some consideration of partisan makeup, although it may be a minor part. I wasn't keeping track of my time. You want me to come up with a third one, or is that good enough?
Well, you actually went very fast. And as somebody who's had a split time with you before, and who has taken up your, eaten into your time, I think I would now tell you, you can get me back. You've got a few more minutes. You can go ahead. Let me give you a question. When you say people, you said some consideration can be given to, you know, we've got some feedback in this room here. Some consideration can be given to the political outcomes in terms of the number of seats for each side. Do you think, are you saying that it can be because that will be legally permissible and that people will actually do that, or what do you mean by that comment?
Well, yeah, I think people will do that. People, I think it was being done before. And again, the senator and Mark, you know, were in the rooms. And so I think it was being done before. To the extent anyone was reluctant to sort of say it out loud, for want of a better term, or to make a record, that's exactly what was happening. In other words, hey, we're going to protect an incumbent now. We want maps that protects incumbents, or we want maps that produce a certain amount of Republican seats versus Democrat seats. I don't see any reason people should be reluctant to make that record under the current state of the law. Eddie, let me throw out one other thing that is perhaps drifting a little from your instruction, but I think it's really interesting. Maybe we can talk about it later. The other thing that I think is really interesting about Cleaner Missouri, right? The version that cleaned up the clean, is the change in the language about based on citizens versus based on, the language is really important. Somebody will tell me, I think it says voters or eligible voters. And that, you know, appears to be, Eddie, you probably know better than any of us, but that appears to be specifically addressing, whether intentional or not, a case that came up out of Texas as to whether the committees or whether those drawing maps could consider only eligible voters versus considering every citizen. And, you know, what you hear people talk about is those who are under 18, for example. We can get into this later, maybe, if you want to talk about it, Eddie. I'm not convinced that's going to make a big difference at the end of the day, but it does appear to open at least an argument that the districts can be drawn a little bit differently based on different data than, or not, that's the wrong word for it, not different data, but using, looking at different subsets of the data than was used previously.
Duly noted as your third point. Very good. Okay. Mr. Ellinger, you have the floor.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate being here, Eddie. You're always welcome to use a conference room. Chuck, I'm guessing when you and I started law school together all those years ago, we never figured we'd be doing this 35 years later, whatever it is, 25 years later. And I think it's important to talk about this with, if you don't mind, Eddie, I'll take a little liberty with your question, just to give a little background here, which is, you know, the population has a lot of control of this. The number one factor under now cleaner, I hate these terms, by the way, I think it was dirty Missouri, the not quite as dirty Missouri, and now we've got what we're stuck with. So, but is population is having equal numbers in districts. And we're waiting on the census data. God knows when that'll come. I know we'll probably talk about that later, but you know, using projections, every Senate seat's gonna have about 180,000 people in it. Every House seat's gonna have about just less than 38,000 people in it. So when you start looking at a map, it gets, the Senate map is so much easier to draw than the House map because of the size and of population that goes into the Senate districts. So from having served 10 years ago, I guess it's actually 9 years ago, I served on the Senate Reapportionment Commission version 2, because version 1 couldn't reach an agreement and it went to the courts. The judges couldn't figure out how to follow the Constitution either, which we could have a nice, interesting discussion about that. And the Supreme Court threw out the judges' plan as being unconstitutional and sent it back to a commission, which is when I was appointed. And we did come up with a plan. So I think that's important. A little bit of background is that doing a Senate map is always going to be easier than doing a House map. And I'll leave it to Senator O'Loughlin to talk about the House maps, because boy, that's interesting. So where we sit now, we used to have 10 member commissions. We're going to have 20 member commissions now. And that's, I think, potentially the biggest problem with the new proposal we're working underneath. Both prior and currently, you had to have a supermajority of the commission to approve a map. So you couldn't cram it through on a partisan basis. You had to actually have a bipartisan map. You needed 7 to 10. Now you need 14 to 20. And that doesn't sound like anything different. It's the same percentage, but it's a lot more difficult to do. The makeup of the commissions are different because they're appointed by congressional districts with a limited input from the state parties. Whereas in the past, it was the state parties that put up the slates. So I think that's going to make it practically a harder to come to compromise on some of these districts, which potentially means an even higher likelihood ending up at the courts. And if anybody's concept was of the final version that we're going to work under, that we wouldn't go to the courts, it's not written that way. It's written to go to the courts. So I assume that while the commissions will work very diligently, and there's a real possibility maybe the Senate commission can reach a compromise, it would be very hard for the House commission to reach a compromise and not end up there. So that's point one I would make. Point two is, you know, if you look at the language that was in Clean, the original one 4 years ago, that efficiency gap created some real problems in the state like Missouri. And I think the one good thing about the new version is taking that out, or basically cramming it to the bottom to make it almost an afterthought, is you have to follow federal voting rights law. I mean, you don't get a choice on that as a state. You have to follow that. And that's always the first and primary thing you have to follow. Even though the Constitution says equal numbers, the federal courts have actually said that, you know, minority rights trump that number and create a potential issue there. So when you looked at the old version of Clean Missouri, you either had to come up with the most bizarre districts in the world because you had to protect certain minority amount of representation. And the minority community in Missouri is almost entirely concentrated in two clusters, one in St. Louis and one in Kansas City. and they're very densely clustered in that area. To come up with what statewide averages were going to be, which at the time looked like they would be about 54, 46, maybe 55, 45 Republican, Democrat, you're going to have to entirely dilute the minority vote, which is illegal. You couldn't do that. So you were going to end up having to preserve the minority vote, which then made it impossible to come up with a 54 or 55% Republican district. I mean, mathematically impossible to do that. So the original way was just not going to work. I don't know how anybody could get it to work. That concept of the efficiency gap could work in congressional districting. I don't think there's any way you could do it in state house redistricting, in a state that has a lot of particularly state rep seats, but also Senate seats. So I think that's going to be something that we'll be thankful for, that that's gone. That's going to create its own set of problems if we get down to the litigating on those issues. Because, you know, first we do equal population, then we do, pursuant to the Constitution, then we do the following federal law. Then we get into the contiguous nature. And for contiguousness, I think there's a lot of opportunity to keep districts together. We have a lot of small counties. It's easy to put small counties together to get districts. If you look at the current maps, and I should, maybe when they switch around, I'll pull up the maps and we can put them on screen so folks can see them. But, you know, the Senate districts, aside from the urban areas, are very large, and they're almost entirely multi-counties. I think the only counties in this next cycle that for sure won't get split, or excuse me, that will get split, are going to be St. Louis County, St. Charles County, St. Louis City, Jackson County, Greene County, Clay County, and Jefferson County, and then Boone County is going to be right on the line. So all the rest of the 114 counties in the city of St. Louis, we're going to take out six, maybe seven of them, and everybody else is going to be set in a single contiguous district inside their county, or their county will be inside a single district as a whole. So ultimately, I don't know that there's going to be that much in the way of changes from the way it was done 10 years ago, because much of this is the same. I just think that the getting compromise done is going to be very difficult. And to go to Chuck's, I guess, inquiry before, from serving on the Senate Reapportionment Commission in a time crunch situation, which we were back then, because we were in 2012, as opposed to in 2011. And I think there's a possibility we're going to end up in that same time crunch by the time we get census numbers this time around. We kind of knew we had to compromise. And while each side pushed as hard as they could to get as much as they could, everybody knew in the end we were going to have to compromise because there wasn't enough time to do it a different way. So we did get districts done. I think there's, you know, that's something that just needs to be kept in mind. There was never a discussion about we want this many Republican seats. We want this many. We don't want this many Democrat seats. It was pushing and pulling on where lines were moved up and down. And I think ultimately we had to compromise.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ellinger. Finally, Senator O'Loughlin, you've heard from two different attorneys here, not necessarily fighting yet, not necessarily disagreeing yet, but if you could unmute yourself there, and tell us, based on your experience on the House committee, what you see as maybe being different this time around.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think I have to explain what I experienced. Our committee went around the area and had several public meetings where people came in and gave public testimony. And I think we had like three or four of those. And then ultimately we ended up getting together to actually draw the map. And you have to understand in my area, it's pretty solid Republican. I mean, it's very hard to, we have a couple of little areas where we have some Democrat populations, but trying to figure out a way to draw the map so that we included them was kind of hard. So we met in Kirksville, I recall that, and we were really only there 2 or 3 hours and we were finished. So this time, I mean, like our rural senators, like I have 14 counties, the thought of adding any more on there is not attractive. And I think in all of our rural areas, you're going to run into that very same situation. I think where the biggest issue might be would be in your suburbs, trying to, you know, represent both parties as best you can. So I don't really see it being a whole lot different. I don't know. I think the House districts will be kind of a nightmare. They were a nightmare the last time, kind of, trying to figure out a way to, you know, have the right amount of population. Another thing you have to consider is in our rural areas, especially northern Missouri, we've lost a lot of population. So you end up drawing some kind of bizarre configurations to get the right amount of population involved. But overall, I do take the point of trying to get 14 people out of 20. I think that might be kind of a high bar. And I could see that resulting in a lot of conversation. That I think will be the biggest, really the biggest issue. It'll be hard to get 14 people out of 20. But as far as I'm concerned, the rest of it is pretty similar. I mean, it has to be contiguous and everybody's looking at the same data. Wonder when we'll get the data. Is there any prediction about that?
Yes, there is. And maybe we can segue, Senator, from that into a side topic for a minute, because now you're the second panelist who raised that. So there'll be two sets of data coming out. There's you know, coarse data and then more granular data. So the coarser data will be coming out, I think, at the end of April. And that's the data that tells each state basically how many people are there for purposes of apportioning, you know, members of Congress to that state. That's a very high level data set, okay? And then later we'll get the more granular census block data that will then, that each party will then feed into their own proprietary systems to draw things out. So here's an interesting point. I'll just throw this out to everybody. The data we need, we won't have until September 30th. That's what the Census Bureau is saying. Now, I think there's a lawsuit filed to try to get them to do it faster. I think maybe Ohio filed that lawsuit recently, but let's just assume that that doesn't work. Okay, so we don't get the data until September. If you've got 6 months from then, we're in some trouble. But if you look at the language of the Constitution, and I know that I would bet Mr. Hatfield has looked at this issue too. The Constitution runs the formation of these committees off the time that the population of the state is, I think it says reported to the governor, or maybe reported to the president. So that's the first, I believe that's the first wave of reports in April. Okay. So I think the committees can actually go through the process of getting formed, which could take 60 days, and have that underway so that when the more granular data comes out, they're not just starting from scratch. The committees are well into their time period. So that's my hypothesis.
You know, one of the things nobody mentioned, and I know about it in our area, and I would assume it was the same everywhere else, with the COVID situation happening, there was a big gap in the gathering of data and filling out forms. And, you know, people were going to go door to door, you know, if you didn't turn in your form. But there was such confusion about that, because I had a couple of the people who had applied to work and do that, but then nobody contacted them and it was just kind of a mess. So I'm a little bit concerned about how that's going to turn out and how accurate it really is. I don't know how accurate it is anyway, but I think that might pose some differences that we did not have the last time.
Well, okay, thank you, Senator. Let me keep that out. Mr.
Ellen. Let me say, there's a couple things here. First of all, you know, filing opens the end of February of 2022. So you got to backtrack. The end of February is the end of August. If you don't have a commission set up by the end of August, you're going to have a really hard time, assuming the commission works, making it to filing date, much less if it doesn't work. If we get the raw population numbers, the unrefined, and it's census block data is the critical data that you have to have. If you don't get the census block data, you end up with the bulk number, which tells you nothing. In fact, I think it actually tells you basically what I said when I did my introductory comments, that a district's going to be roughly 180,000 people. The only thing it'll change is it won't be roughly 180,000 people. I'll be able to refine that down to, you know, it's going to be 180,513 people or whatever the number becomes. That's all that number gets you, nothing else. So it's useless information. It doesn't even really give you a great opportunity to start planning, because the planning is drawing the lines. And I think the senator is exactly right. It's the suburbs where that's so difficult. And you can't do anything in the suburbs without census block data. At least on whole counties, you have a shot maybe of getting earlier data that will be, you know, sufficient, but you still can't draw the lines inside the district. So if we get data by the end of April, the governor, the committees have, I think, what, 60 days to nominate and the governor to select. I would tell the governor, wait till the last day. I wouldn't appoint the commission until you have to, because all that time that creates before you have data is almost useless time. Now, I had a little different experience than the senator did it on the House commission, because you know, we were a year late on doing the Senate. We were already through it all. So we had really great data. We were able to sit down and start proposing maps within 15 minutes of sitting down inside our you know, respective caucuses, so to speak. But that's because we had all the granular data. If you don't have the granular data, there's just not much you can do. And the clock burns.
I'm going to hear from Mr. Hatfield on this topic. Which do you think that the April data release triggers the requirement to start forming committees? You have to unmute.
I thought I did that a minute ago. Thank you for reminding me. I do. And since you were, you know, trying to get disagreement going, I'll pick a fight with Mark and say, I would move quickly on getting my committees appointed, because there are a lot of moving parts here and things can go wrong. And I've been doing this so long that I can't remember what year it was. There was a year that there was a dispute over, you know, whether the committees had properly whether the parties had properly nominated their people. I think that was when Bob Holden was governor. So
2001. Yep.
2001. So there was a dispute over how that worked and whether they had properly nominated, because if the parties don't properly nominate it, I think then the governor, I don't know how it works these days. I haven't looked at it, but so there are some moving parts you got to work through, and getting as much of that done as early as possible. I think having your committees ready to go is probably going to be a good idea, just as a practical matter. Eddie, I pulled it up while you were talking. And so the language is that in the current constitution, within 60 days after the population of this state is reported to the president. So once the president gets the population of the state, then within 60 days of that, the state committee and the congressional district committees sort of kick in to the nominating process. So they could go ahead and do that. You know, whether the governor waits till last day or not, I mean, he could. Like I said, I think there are some opportunities there to, you know, for things to go wrong. The only other thing I would add, kind of getting a little bit off topic, is, you know, this whole idea of having the judges do it, I think almost everybody agrees is not a great idea. I know the judges don't want to do it. The judiciary hates the idea. You know, you can get a panel of judges who know a little something about politics, but you can also get people who have no idea exactly what they're doing. And as Mark said, you know, last time around, they didn't follow. The judicial panel didn't follow the Constitution, according to the Supreme Court. So, you know, that whole process, regardless of the timing, you know, it can really delay us, as Mark experienced.
I have a question for, maybe this is better for Mr. Ellinger and Senator O'Loughlin, but even though the panels have increased in size, who chooses the panels? We've got multiple inputs coming in, and the choosing is being done by committees that don't have a lot of regular function and maybe aren't even used to getting together. They may have to go back and look to remember exactly who's on that committee. And so do you think that this allows for some wild cards to be appointed to the committee, so that maybe you do actually get the 14, because you've got so many different interests out there that's actually possible to create some of those deals, trading off, minority, even if they're not majority minority districts in St. Louis, they're, you know, maybe minority coalition districts, but then trading off for a Republican district over here, that, you know, a seat in Springfield for something in St. Louis County. Isn't that maybe more likely with the bigger committee? What do you think?
Senator, why don't you take it first?
All right. Who's on these committees that, that are choosing? Can you?
Oh, it's the congressional, I can hit that real quick. It's the congressional district committee of each party. So, you know, each party, there's a county committee district, and then each legislative district has a legislative committee district, and then each Senate seat has a Senate district, and then the congressional district committee is made up of representatives of all the legislative and Senate committee districts. So, okay.
Well, again, I have to speak from a rural perspective. I don't think that there'll be much... there won't be a lot of deal making there, but I think when you get to the suburbs, and I could see it maybe then being a little bit of a wild card and people a little more actively involved and trying to get what they want out of it.
I guess from my perspective, I think it probably gets harder because in Congress, so the state party, think of the two state parties. The state parties, while, you know, one's more conservative and one's more liberal, they have a mix of conservative and liberal, and to come up with their approved nominees, they have to blend that list and put people together. Whereas in congressional districts, I mean, there are some congressional districts where there's not going to be any blending of liberal and conservative because they're going to be adding, you know, some of the congressional districts are very, very conservative. And then in some of the congressional districts that are not very, that are, you know, use the first congressional district, which has very few Republicans, it's likely that the few Republicans that are there are incredibly conservative Republicans and are going to appoint themselves, and they're not going to be in the compromising mood, and vice versa for Democrat districts. I mean, you know, you look at the fourth congressional district, which represents a big part of the state, but almost all the Democrats in the fourth congressional district live in Boone County. Unlikely that they're going to sit down and say, we should appoint some real moderate Democrats to negotiate in a college town, college environment. So I think it's tough. I think it's, I don't know who wrote this, but whoever wrote it, I think wrote it with an intention to get it to the courts. And if they didn't intend that, that's clearly what the result is.
Let me ask this question. So you'll see that the governor, that the state party has a role. The state party itself, for the Republicans and Democrats, is ultimately responsible for two of the nominees on each of these committees. And so, but what's interesting is that the state party nominates five, and the governor picks only two of those five, right? So the governor has more discretion and power here, even for the opposite party's nominees, than ever before. And so let me just ask, what if anything, do you think the effect of that will be on the makeup ultimately of these committees and on whether they're able to cut deals?
I'll stand on my prior comments.
It's going to be chaos. No.
I haven't been on either of these.
Tell you already. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage, but I think Mark may be not giving enough credit to, there is some level of coordination that goes on statewide to try to make sure that the folks that get nominated, if possible, right, you know, are more or less at least in the same hymn book, if not on the same page. About how the respective parties are going to approach all this. And I do agree with Mark that, you know, adding 20 people or expanding them out makes it much harder to coordinate. But if you look back at the, you know, how this has worked historically and who ends up on the committees, there's, you know, these are folks who kind of understand what the perspective of the various parties is going to be. you usually end up with two or three leaders from each party who are fairly obvious, I think, to the committees. Hey, these are the folks who have given this the most thought. They've met with party leadership. They've, you know, they've got a plan. Mark was probably that person on the Senate committee, so he doesn't want to admit that it was all, you know, wired for him to direct the thing. But it's, I mean, the senator says, it, you know, chaos, you know, controlled chaos, right? It's going to be a little harder to herd everyone, but I think there is coordination that goes into this. I think it's pretty unusual, as my kids would say, for a rando to show up on these committees.
I think that's a good point. I mean, especially the further up the chain you go, I mean, these are people who are used to openly discussing things with both parties, and they kind of know that nobody really gets everything they want, and so they're kind of in the mode of, okay, we, you know, there will be some compromise that has to be made. So in that respect, I think you're right. I just think 14 people is a lot of people, regardless of how used to it they are. 14 is a lot of people.
But, and I guess the thing is because you have the 8 congressional district committees picking, you know, I think the governor and whoever the titular head of the Democrat Party is, probably would have a pretty decent level of influence upon their state committee. But as you trickle down in these congressional districts, they lose much of that influence, if not all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that's where I think you have, I mean, the theory that the governor's appointees from the state party might make it easier for compromise, I think is going to struggle quite a bit on the rocks of those congressional district appointees.
And I would just add the smart legislators in those suburban districts where they know this is going to be a fight will start thinking about this early and start mm-hmm. making sure that they have talked to the people that they need to talk to. So while the governor or, you know, whoever it is in the Democratic Party may not be able to control all of this process, the people that really have the dog in the fight, if they're smart, are going to get in there early and start to think about all of this.
There's nothing more important to politicians than staying in. So believe me, they're talking about it right now.
Well, thank you all for your comments on that. And if there were any legislators watching, we may have lost a few just now who suddenly are decided that they need to get to work. But for everybody else, I'm going to move on to topic 2. And this is a more purely legal topic. The question here I want to pose is whether and to what extent Missouri courts ought to consider claims that legislative maps reflect unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering. So, we'll have to take less time on this topic, maybe 4 or 5 minutes for Mark and Chuck each, and then for Senator O'Loughlin. Feel free to weigh in on this, although I know you've been probably busily checking your committee schedule too. but one thing I want to add, the basis for this question is we know that there's not a federal partisan gerrymandering claim, but of course there could be a state one. Now you would think that maybe the cleaned up version of Clean forecloses that, but maybe creative minds believe that that's not true, or they think they can locate that somewhere else in the Constitution. So that's the basis for this question. And again, I'll just repeat it. Well, this time we'll start with Mark, by the way, then go to Chuck. To what extent should Missouri courts consider claims that state legislative maps reflect unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering?
They shouldn't. That's the first standard. But that being said, look, anything that comes out of a commission is going to be hard to argue as a partisan gerrymander when you have a bipartisan commission that requires a supermajority vote. I mean, that seems to me to be almost per se evidence that it's not partisan gerrymandering. You'd have to make the argument, say something passed with the minimum number of votes, 14 votes. You'd have to make the argument that, you know, okay, all 10 Republicans voted and the 4 Democrats that supported it weren't really Democrats. The fix was in. And you're going to have to tear down their credentials. So I think it's very difficult, if not almost impossible, to get that partisan gerrymandering claim under these redistricting statutes. I mean, even if the courts follow the Constitution, it's the last item in the constitutional provision. So, you know, first you have to have the population numbers, then you have to follow the federal law, then you have to do contiguous. There's a lot of steps underneath the continuous and compactness. And only then do you get to the competitiveness, which is the first place I think really arguably you hit the argument of partisan gerrymandering. I mean, I know we're not talking about congressional redistricting so much on this panel. That's where you could have a real argument on partisan gerrymandering, because congressional redistricting is done by the General Assembly, and with the supermajority in the House and the Senate and the governor, theoretically that would open you up to an argument that there would be partisan gerrymandering there. The constitutional provisions just make that a really difficult argument. Now, I would throw out the question, and maybe it's a Chuck Eddie legal question here, which is, what if the commissions can't agree and the nonpartisan judiciary, notice I use the quotation marks on nonpartisan judiciary, comes up with a partisan map? I mean, how do you show a map is a partisan gerrymander if it's drawn by judges, all of whom, let's say, were appointed by a Democrat governor, just hypothetically, but have to be nonpartisan to be judges? I mean, I think that becomes a much more interesting issue of the partisan gerrymandering claim if that occurs. And that, you know, it wasn't raised, I don't believe, in the Senate case 10 years ago that threw out the Senate districts, but it certainly could have been argued that they cracked things open in the attempt to gerrymander. Now, in the end, they didn't follow the law, so it didn't matter.
Thank you, Mark. You raised some good questions. I'd like to have Chuck go, but I want to give Senator O'Loughlin a shot here because I think she's got to run. Senator O'Loughlin, what are your comments on that point?
Well, on the first go around, I didn't know how you would prove that something wasn't drawn fairly. And I really still have that question. I mean, what are the criteria? How do you measure it? And Mark said, I agreed with the whole first part of his comment. You know, you've already got 14 people out of 20 and you've held several meetings and you've done the best you can. I don't know how they prove that. I've always wondered that. And I think that's why 10 years ago, they couldn't come to a conclusion that had been done.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. And I will say thank you for joining us today as well. I appreciate this. I know it's in the middle of committee hearings and things for you. We've happened to make it work out, but thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. Okay. Mr. Hatfield, now you've had all kinds of time to think about what Mr. Ellen, what's your response?
Well, Eddie, you framed that as should the courts consider it. And, you know, I have to admit, I'm not very good at should they questions. Like you and most of the people who are watching this, I think I'm usually an advocate for a position. So I'm better at you tell me what the position is and I'll tell you what the strongest arguments are than whether, you know, what the policy should or should not be. Rucho was 5-4. It would probably be 6-3 today, most likely. But it was 5-4 decision. I tried to find this language in Rucho while I was getting ready to talk and I couldn't find it, but I seem to recall that the majority sort of said, you know, at what point does partisan gerrymandering get so bad that we consider it? That's been our history. And then they went on to say, well, you know, this is the political question doctrine and we cannot consider it. The dissent, by the way, it's a really well-written opinion for those of you on both sides, for those of you who enjoy kind of thinking through the way opinions are written. I believe it was Kagan who wrote the dissent. And if you want to do legal writing, it's one of those kind of cool opinions that the beginning of every sentence refers back to the last sentence, you know, lots of ands, lots of buts, lots of therefores. It's really smooth and it's a cool opinion to go back and read. In the category of should they, I mean, I guess I could envision law school exam questions where it's so bad that there is an equal protection argument, which is I think, the better argument that was advanced in Rucho. Now, I will argue a little bit against type, since I'm supposed to be the foil here, I suppose, to Mark's position. I agree that it's probably just not workable to, which is one of the points the U.S. Supreme Court made, to engage in this partisan gerrymandering. Folks that own farms are probably not able to control elections in some of the suburban areas, right? Folks that own guns, gay people, may not have enough power together. So I don't know how you draw the line and say, okay, we're going to address the fact that, you know, Republicans are really disenfranchised in this district because, you know, they're only 30% of the voters, or Democrats are disenfranchised in that district. I just really don't know where you stop once you start that. I do think it's possible that there are times when they should look at it. Mark dove into Missouri's system. I think the way Missouri's set up, you're going to start with an extremely strong rebuttable presumption that process is going to produce a nonpartisan map. It's possible you have some Manchurian candidate members, I suppose. There is also, of course, a history, not as much recently, but a history of deal cutting, years and years ago, where